桑伊拉
贵
Y-E beats Nak Seal
Tan She
Tanek E Negad Dakote
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Bon matin, bon après-midi, bonsoir. Good morning, afternoon, or evening, depending on where you're tuning in or when you're tuning in. This is Words and Culture, the Mischief episodes. Sheila Rogers, Dishini Kashun. My name is Sheila Rogers, and it's my honor to accompany you through these programs, meeting Mischief speakers, artists, and practitioners of the culture. Last time, I talked a little bit about my Métis great-great-grandmother, Lydia Catherine Christie. She lived in Norway House, Manitoba, up at the tip of Lake Winnipeg. I mentioned she was an amazing embroidery artist, and a few months ago, I went to the Manitoba Museum, and I was given permission to see and touch a jacket she made for her husband, Donald McTavish. He was a fur trader and clerk with the Hudson Bay Company. The jacket is made from smoke-tanned moose and caribou hides. And the floral embroidery was a tight buttonhole stitch, tiny, tiny little stitches. I have to say, Donald must have looked resplendent, and Lydia must have been so proud. I was shaking just touching it, knowing my great-great-grandmother dreamed that jacket into being, and she held it and she stitched it. As what I call a Métis come lately, myself, that is, I didn't know that my father's family was Métis till I was in my 50s, feeling that link to my ancestors through objects, like Lydia's embroidery or her mother Mary Sinclair's beadwork, was emotional and very, very powerful. I was verklempt. Today's guest is known for her paintings inspired by Métis beadwork. Christie Belcourt's work hangs in the Gabriel Dumont Institute in Saskatoon, the Art Gallery of Ontario, the Wabano Centre for Aboriginal Health in Ottawa, and the National Gallery, also in many private collections. In the summer of 2024, Canada Post issued a stamp with Christie's face on it, set against the background of one of her intricate paintings, part of Canada Post's Indigenous Leaders series. Christie is passionate about showing us how beautiful the universe can be if we just quit interfering with it and disrupting the wisdom of nature. But today, she wants to talk about her other abiding passion, keeping the language strong and healthy. I invited Christie to introduce herself in her own way.
Christie Belcourt, Nitsika Son, Mantus Hagayagan, Ochinia, and I live in a place called Espanola right now. So my name is Christie Belcourt, and my ancestry comes from the community of Mantos Hagayagan, which is in English called Lac St. Anne, Alberta.
It's important to you to reclaim the original place names, isn't it?
About 20 years ago or so, I just started to get really curious as my entry into reclaiming my language started. And so I started to get really curious about people I would hear talk about places when they were speaking the language. Slowly, I began to recognize that every single place here in what is now called Canada has an original place name that was part of the erasure of our land use and our existence on the lands. And I feel like a lot of places have some names, they've retained some names, but they don't know what those meanings are, and they're mispronounced. But then there's a lot of places that have completely been run over with English names. And part of this renaming was part of the claiming of land by settler colonists.
So the original place name for Lac St. Anne, Manadou Sagaigan?
That's right, yeah. Manadou Sagaigan.
Thank you. It doesn't translate literally, obviously, as Lac Saint Anne.
No, that's for sure. It translates to Spirit Lake because of the belief of the healing waters of the lake. It's been known as a place for medicines and spiritual strength for a really long time. It's a large lake on the prairies, you know, in comparison to, you know, other spots. And it was a place that was utilized and well known and lived on and around by Indigenous people since the beginning of time. So this place, Spirit Lake, was renamed in 1844 by a priest who set up the first Catholic mission in that place. And his patron saint, I suppose, was Saint Anne. And so he renamed the lake Lac Saint Anne and then declared, I think, that the translation of Manito Sagaigan, the Manito part, which is spirit, he declared that to mean devil, of course. Uh-huh. And so the English, you'll find a lot of places across Canada.
Devil's Lake.
And so that's because the actual, probably the literal translation in the Indigenous language meant spirit.
Mm. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredibly insulting.
I'd like to ask you about language in your family. What did your grandparents speak?
They spoke Cree.
Ah.
That's what everyone spoke in this community. The community of Lac Saint Anne or Manito Sagaigan is a Cree-speaking Métis community, as are a lot of Métis communities in the northern regions of Saskatchewan and Alberta. And also, we're not northern, we're west of Edmonton. But when I talk to my elder, like I've been going to visit with this elder named Judy Hilbert, and she is over the age of 80. She's a fluent speaker. Her first language is Cree. And when I went to go interview her and record, we're doing some recordings, I asked her, what do you call your language? And she said, Nehiyawewin. And I said, okay, what about, what is that in English? And she said, Cree. And I said, okay, what do you think about the word Michif? Like, there's a lot of people in Edmonton and region Alberta who have been saying that our language is Michif. And she said, well, that's not what I would call it. That's not what I grew up hearing. I said, what did your parents call it? She said, Cree. I said, and your grandparents? She said, Cree. And I said, well, does it bother you that people are saying it's Michif? And she said, no, you know, people can do what they want, but I'm going to call it Cree because that's what I know it as.
Hmm. Hmm. That's so interesting. And your parents, too, did they speak Cree?
No, my grandparents, their first language was Cree, and that's what they spoke really well. And they also spoke English and a little bit of French. Hmm. But they didn't learn English until later. And so their first language, their one they were most comfortable in, was Cree. And everyone spoke it of their generation. But unfortunately, like so many families across the country, my grandparents made the decision that they didn't want to see their kids struggle the way that they did. And so they decided not to speak the language in the home around the kids. And my dad's first language, my dad, Tony, his first language was Cree till about 5 years old, until he started going to school. And when he started going to school, he was really struggling. And the kids and teachers and everybody were quite cruel about it. So he was having a really hard time, and that's when they made the decision. And my dad's the oldest sibling. So after that, his younger siblings were too young to ever start to speak the language. So he was the only one in my family, in my immediate family of my uncles and aunts and my dad.
I saw him jigging last year at Batosh, and I think he's got the rhythm, he's got the music, he's got the language. It all comes through when he dances. He was amazing.
Oh, yeah. My dad is Métis to the core. You know, there's he is just Métis mm-hmm. all the way through, which is what our ancestry is, right? I did this winter, my project for the family was to do a great big poster-sized circle genealogy tree. What was really fascinating to me was discovering how many in our family tree had taken treaty but been removed from treaty in 1886 and 1887 after the Métis script commissions went through. And it's a really fascinating history. Like out of, I think there was like 30 people who had taken treaty and who had, no, I'm wrong in those numbers. It's more like 13 who had taken treaty and who had been withdrawn from treaty. And there's a very fascinating history that really has never been told about Métis people in what is now Alberta and how their land through the script process was stolen from them, right, just blatantly stolen. And how people who were on treaty were really forced at a time when there was starvation, disease, you know, people who were living on reserve, for example, you know, you got $5 a year, there's smallpox, there's flu, there's all sorts of things going through. The buffalo are really disappearing. You can't move. And then a script commission comes along and says, hey, we can give you what is equivalent to $5,000 right now for your family if you move off this reserve and leave and go anywhere else you want. So a lot of families said, you know, I think I'll take my chances. Better to be off because this way of life is not working out for us.
It's a horrible, twisted history.
It's fascinating. It's twisted. It's terrible. And it's never been, never really been spoken about. You know, the idea that you would sign script in 1885, and then if you wanted land script, for example, you wanted to stay on your land and be there, you had to send away for the, what they call the letters patent. And they would send it to Ottawa. You know, and they didn't have fax machines and airplanes right. And big trucks, right? So this might take the whole season or a year to get to Ottawa. Ottawa would then send another letter back saying, we're in receipt of your application. Please fill this thing out. And then they would send it back again. I think it'd be a fascinating thing to if somebody did a map showing how much land was applied for as Métis script and which families.
It's interesting just thinking about language, too. Not everybody would have been able to understand the application. Not everyone spoke English.
That's right. There was translators. There were witnesses. There were people, a lot of my ancestors marked an X mm-hmm. where their signature went because they were not, they couldn't read or write. But there was a lot of trust. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't think that your own... Well, not your own, but you don't think that people are going to set out to steal from you and do mm-hmm. all that, right? You know, it's only in hindsight that you realize what happened.
Christy, what has made you, what has ignited your passion for language?
It comes from a place of, like, two places. One is... Within the language, you always hear people say when you know a different language, it doesn't even have to be an Indigenous language, but when you know different languages, you think differently. So it expands the way that you can see the world. It gives you a broader perspective. And I think that I'm fascinated by the idea of how limiting my mind is through just knowing English, and then how... Even from what I've learned so far, how my mind has expanded. And that's fascinating to me. So I can only imagine how it is if I would, if I were to be able to learn more in terms of becoming more fluent. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing that, you know, it's a matter of feeling whole. Mm-hmm. There's a place inside of me where the language needs to be that's empty. And it's like a bowl. And every time I learn a word or a phrase or a new rule of the language, it starts to fill that bowl up. And it's part of knowing who I am. And I also have a, you know, the fact that they purposely tried to remove, like the Canadian government purposely tried to destroy our languages, makes me, you know, on the political end of things, angry enough to want to do it. So on Canada Day, I always spend part of the day always learning a little bit of my language. That's my way of doing some reclamation work on this day.
I love how you said bowl, how you put it in a bowl, which is round. It's a circle. It's not a box.
Yeah. I think of a bowl as a ceremonial item too, because a lot of times we have our feasts and we have our food in bowls and we have our tobacco in bowls and we have our cedar in bowls and whatever else we use. It's always in a bowl. So I always think about that. Yeah.
As you learn the language and you learn the different names, say for plants, I wonder what that means to you to know, for instance, that Labrador tea doesn't literally translate into Cree as Labrador tea.
It translates into like the muskeg plant, right? So there's so many, right, that have connections to different things. Like, for example, in Anishinaabemowin, which I'm also learning, is cedar is called Gijik, right? Mm. So, or sometimes it's called Gijikonduk, but Gijik. And so it's also people I've heard who know the language speak about how there's a connection to the day with that. So there's like, there's a lot of cross connections with language, with our languages that are like, often you'll hear elders say that the words can have two meanings. Like one of my language teachers said that. They say all our words can have two meanings. Then the other thing that fascinates me is how many different names there are for the same plant, depending on community, depending on language, depending on dialect. There's also some very generic names for plants that don't necessarily carry this super, super spiritual meaning. You know, not everything's super sacred, right? So like it's just a name. Mm-hmm. It's always important too to stay light and keep laughing as you're learning the language, because as a language learner, I can talk for days on the process of being a language learner. And so it's really important to know how to laugh, and especially laugh at yourself and laugh when others people who are teaching are not laughing, are never laughing at you. They're laughing because what you said has a turn of phrase that they understand to be a double meaning and sometimes is funny. Mm-hmm. So, or sometimes the mistakes are funny. Like for one, when I was first learning, I was so proud to be able to say, oh, my name is, you know, I am from, type of thing.
Yeah.
But I was living in a little place called Whitefish Falls, and I said, my name is Whitefish Falls. And I was like all proud and everybody laughed. So, you know, as a learner, I'm going to make lots of mistakes. The plant names are like, I'm starting to know more and more of them. And there's a couple of them that I knew first in the language and then knew them in English. Like they're completely not the same.
I think about, again, I'm going to go back to Labrador tea, because I was actually in Northern Labrador in the company of some Inuit elders, and I asked them what that plant was, and it was Labrador tea as I know it. But for them, it was plant that makes beautiful smell when you step on it. I mean, that's a very like simplistic translation of something that was actually really beautiful. But in fact, it was how you could recognize the plant out in nature. If you stepped on it and you smell this beautiful aroma rising up, there's your Labrador tea. And I really like that. It's like it comes with instruction in the name.
That is really beautiful. Yeah, see, that's different from ours, right? Which is, muskeg.
Muskeg, yeah. Yeah. Who have been your language mentors?
I live in Anishinaabeg territory, and I've lived here for 20 years on the North Shore region of Lake Huron, entry into Manitoulin Island. And so I've lived here for about 20 years. And when I was really wanting to learn my language, my mentor and elder Maria Campbell said, just learn Anishinaabemowin. It's really close. It's really similar. And she said, it will be a doorway into Cree. And everyone speaks that over there, so it'll be easier for you. So I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a whirl. So I've been on this journey now for 20 years, and she was right. It did open up a lot of doorways in terms of the grammar patterns of Cree are identical. So there's very, very few things that are not the same. The vocabulary can be similar. For example, the word for land in Anishinaabemowin is ake. And in Cree, it's eske. For beaver, it's a mik or a misk. So there's a lot of similarities in terms of vocabulary, but the grammatical structure, which is the hardest part to master, is the same. So it makes it interesting for me as a learner to jump into Cree, understand the grammatical structure and not have any of the vocabulary. So it's a very weird sort of turn of events.
You've mentioned Maria Campbell, and I know that she's been really important to you and so many of us. But how did she bring you along, I guess, and not necessarily just in terms of language, but teachings and stories?
Oh, Maria has been one of the biggest influences on my life. We are really close. I love her so much. She's my auntie. Her and my dad know each other from way back. So they're like brother and sister. And she's also my elder. So she's the first person who put me out to fast. I fasted on her land for a long time. Received so many teachings. You know, spiritual teachings and ceremonial teachings from her. We have conversations all the time, really deep, interesting conversations that range from everything from writing to art to spirituality to her elders and her teachers and what they taught her to language. She is one of the most fascinating human beings I think I've ever had the pleasure to know. So she's had a really deep and profound influence on me, on my art, on my career, on my life. And then there's Mary Wemigwans. So Mary Wemigwans is a Odawa Anishinaabe elder, originally from Wequemecong. Mm-hmm. And she is a language teacher, and she's been doing it for a really long time. And she's taught me now for about 10 years, and she teaches others. She's like 86 years old, and she's still going strong. She's sharp as a tack, and she loves her language, and she loves teaching it. And she's really good at knowing where a student's at, so she can tailor her lessons to each student.
That's really amazing, like almost psychic. What a gift.
She's amazing. All the elders I've ever come across who have been teaching their language to people are the most generous people I've ever met. They love their language, they're kind, they're patient, and they are just trying their best. And a lot of elders who want to give their language to people struggle too, because they weren't necessarily taught to teach their language, right? So they don't have like the skills to be able to teach at a higher level than beginner. And they struggle to help students who reach those intermediate levels. And they struggle with their own internal shame for not teaching their own kids. It's a phenomenon that's widespread across the country, where people who are completely fluent, because of residential schools and internalized shame, they were not able to speak the language to their children. It's like a block in their throat that just happened. It wasn't because they didn't want to. They physically couldn't. And they still, in some cases, physically can't. But they can teach others. Mm. It's really strange and sad at the same time. Yeah.
Let's hope that in the coming generations, that shame, what Christy called that block in the throat, is replaced by bold, loud pride and joy. With people like Christy Belcourt fighting for the language and creating the best possible space to learn it, I'm hopeful. The Machif word for hope is Swetik. Swetik. Hi, Christy Belcourt, for the honor of spending time with you and for your very generous sharing. Next week on Words and Culture, Dr. Danielle Lussier and her son, Hugo Lussier-Meek. Danielle is chair in Indigenous Knowledges and Perspectives at Queen's University. She was the author of the first PhD thesis in law in Canada ever to be delivered in part in beadwork. Her 13-year-old son, Hugo, is passionate about beadwork too, and about becoming fluent in Machif. He's doing it for the ancestors. Hugo is excited about his future and also about the future of the Machif language. I hope you'll join me and Danielle and Hugo next week on Words and Culture. I'm Sheila Rogers. Kichi Marcy for listening. Kawapitin Mina. I'll see you again.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dang King Sam.
Maltus.
Ninuis Akaka Miku Kwakwal.
Kachu Nautano.
Wapamatin Min. This is Bird Note. Imagine a line of brown pelicans flying just above the breaking surf of the coast. Perhaps you've watched and heard these large, long-billed birds fishing. They circle high, then dive headfirst, plunging underwater to catch fish. But doesn't that hurt? Anyone who's taken a belly flop off a diving board knows the powerful force of hitting the water. Several adaptations protect brown pelicans as they dive, sometimes from as high as 60 feet. Air sacs beneath the skin on their breasts act like cushions. Also, while diving, a pelican rotates its body ever so slightly to the left. This rotation helps avoid injury to the esophagus and trachea, which are located on the right side of the bird's neck. Pelicans have also learned that a steep dive angle between 60 and 90 degrees reduces aiming errors caused by water surface refraction. We know that pelicans learn this behavior because adults are better marksmen than young birds. Upon impact, the brown pelican opens its bill and expands its pouch, trapping small fish inside. Then the bird pops to the surface, spills out the water, and gulps down dinner. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Support for Bird Note comes from the Cornell Labs Bird Academy, with online courses for people of all knowledge levels. More at allaboutbirds.org.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities